Hello, and welcome to another episode of Insight is Capital. I'm Pierre Daly. Since the democratization of alternative investments began 6 years ago, there's been a growing sense that most, if not all, investors now finally have a chance to construct portfolios with a profile similar to that of the way pensions, large institutions, and ultra-high net worth investors have long had access to. But what does that mean in practice, and how do you go about evolving into that mindset and capability? Our special guest today is Brent Smith, Chief Investment Officer at Kinsted Wealth, a firm that has been quietly rewriting what it means to manage money for Canada's high net worth investors. Brent oversees Kinsted's diversified investment pools, a mix of public, private, and alternative strategies, with the kind of precision that comes from more than 30 years inside the global markets machine. Before Kinsted, Brent was deep in the engine room at Franklin Templeton, where he helped build and lead the firm's multi-asset strategies group, the team behind some of Templeton's most globally integrated portfolios. His work there spanned the Americas, Asia, and Europe, giving him a panoramic view of how capital really moves when you zoom out from the day-to-day noise. Today, Brent brings that same institutional perspective home, designing pension-style portfolios for private clients and advisors who are ready to move beyond the traditional 60-40 playbook. He's a CFA charter holder, a strategist, and an educator at heart, someone who believes the future of investing isn't about chasing liquidity, but understanding where access and patience can truly compound wealth.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Brent, welcome. It is great to finally have you on.
Yes, it's thanks for the invite. I'm really looking forward to this, Pierre.
Likewise. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we begin, would you mind telling us a little bit about the arc of your career from your perspective, how you got into the business in the first place, and how you ended up where you are today at Kinsted Wealth?
As you mentioned, I hate to admit it, it's been well over 30 years I've been in the industry. Time really does fly. I know it's people use that expression, but you know, most of my career was with Franklin Templeton. Started way back in the late 80s with an insurance company, and ultimately ended up in their investment management group. Moved out to Calgary, joined a firm called Bissett & Associates that was eventually bought by Franklin Templeton, ended up in the private client side. And then we were asked by the powers that be to launch a fund-to-fund strategy for the Canadian marketplace. And I think the timing couldn't have been better. We had just come out of the technology bubble. People remember that. And I think a lot of advisors at the time had realized that they didn't want to manage their clients' money anymore, and that they started outsourcing it to a product that we had launched called Quotential back in 2002. Right. Launched that with $25,000 seed capital, and within 6 years, it had grown to about $8 billion. I went down to the U.S. to spearhead more of the global multi-asset strategies group, try to grow that business globally, and was there till about, I think, 2014. Ultimately ended up back in Calgary and joined Kinsted just over six and a half years ago to here we are today. Probably one of the best roles I've ever had, recognizing that with Franklin Templeton, it was predominantly retail assets. And I think as soon as you get outside of the retail sphere, the investment universe gets much, much larger. So the opportunity set is much broader where we are today.
Brent, you've built something pretty unique at Kinsted, this blend of institutional DNA and private wealth practicality. What I think makes your story so interesting is that you've lived both sides of the industry. You've said before that diversification is the ultimate free lunch. many people in the business would say diversification means always having to say you're sorry.
Yeah.
But the irony is that few investors really eat from that table. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a difference. I think intellectually, most investors recognize the benefits of diversification.
Right.
But I think there's a behavior gap between knowing and doing. And I think that that's where it gets a bit sticky with a lot of advisors or clients, is that FOMO sets in.
It's classic,
right?
Right.
Yeah. It's FOMO, or I'm concerned that if I've got a diversified portfolio, which, let's face it, over the past couple of years has not added a lot of value. But I think a lot of investors, like I said, they recognize it, but it's that fear of missing out. Why don't I just go 100% in the S&P 500? Have you seen the performance of the S&P 500 over the past 5 years? Why don't I just have the S&P 500, right? Why diversify? But I think a lot of investors I think they recognize, I hope they do anyway, the tail risk of investing or being very concentrated in just in the public markets. A lot of people haven't experienced that significant tail risk. A lot of investors today have experienced COVID and the very drastic drawdown, but very quick recovery. But a lot of investors today have not experienced the GFC or the tech bubble, where the markets don't come back after 3 months. It's a very, very drawn out process. So again, I think, like I said, intellectually people understand it, but I think FOMO and recency bias gets in the way of investors truly diversifying their portfolios.
I saw a great headline today. I saw a great headline this morning, which was, don't quit your diversifier.
Yeah.
Right. That's a perfect setup for the portfolio question. You're not telling anyone to go from zero to 100 overnight. Because at the fringes, when we're emotional beings, that is the way we tend to, think in terms of extremes. Like, why don't I have more exposure? You've got enough. I mean, if you've just got an S&P 500 index in your portfolio, you've got 55% of exposure to the top 10 stocks, you're already overexposed.
Yeah, I just don't think people realize that. I mean, think back to the TSX back in 2000 when Nortel, I think, about 35% of the index.
Exactly. Yeah. What you're really talking about is an evolution. So in that evolution, you have a 50-30-20 structure that you talk about. Walk me through how that 50-30-20 structure came about and what it looks like in the real world.
Yeah, I think just to about the 50-30-20 structure, that's not necessarily our structure. I think that to me is just the starting point. And I know with a lot of firms, a lot of advisors, a lot of investors, that's the end point, right? Because that 20% of alternatives is scary, correct? And so you don't want too much more than 20% in a scary area. For us, that really is just the starting point. The evolution of our investment platform that started back in 2019 was, we looked at what large institutions were doing. What is the Canadian Pension Plan doing? What is Yale and Harvard and Brown University endowment funds being doing? What are sovereign wealth funds been doing for a very long time? And or even ultra high net worth individuals.
Right.
And you looked at what they've been doing for decades and you go, well, why aren't we doing this for our own clients? Right. And so that was really the genesis of taking our transforming our investment platform from a focus just on public markets to one that really embraced the private markets. So why did we embrace the private markets? Not because We just want it to be different. It's because we do believe that over time, private markets will provide significant diversification benefits and potentially some significant return enhancements as well. So that was really the genesis of the start of it. And even, you know, looking at capital market assumptions, which we look at every year, if you look at capital market assumptions today for just public equities over the next decade, it's not that pretty. You know, you're talking about probably on average, maybe 5-6%, significantly below what investors have experienced over the past decade. So I think if you're an advisor or an investor, I think you, if you're expecting to continue to get that 10-12% from public equities, there's going to be a real struggle there. And the only way to, in our opinion, to get incremental growth in your portfolio is to embrace the private markets, be it private infrastructure, private real estate, private equity, or venture cap, or something like that. Or even there's areas such as opportunistic credit that, in our opinion, will outperform public equity over the next decade. So I think, you know, when you talk about diversification and the free lunch, It's tough to get that free lunch just in the public markets today, given the tighter correlation between stocks and bonds. And so, you know, if you really want a true institutional style diversified portfolio, you really do have to embrace the private markets.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what's missing from today's traditional portfolios, it is all of the other markets. It is all the other places where you can get uncorrelated returns, or the strategies where you can get uncorrelated returns that are structural, not in some cases are structural, structural alpha or structural returns that you can build into a portfolio, as opposed to just relying on economic or interest rate risk or credit risk to drive your returns. There are strategic returns that are available, structurally strategic returns that are available in so many different quadrants of the market. I think it's interesting, you know, that you bring up, you know, we're talking about the evolution into this pension mindset of investing. And, you know, it's sort of gearing up for our conversation, I was just thinking also of, you know, the fact that, you know, we take that for granted, right? We know CPP exists. We know, you know, all these pension funds exist, that all these multinational corporations that people sometimes work for 30, 40 years at. But, you know, when we come across our neighbor who worked somewhere for 30 years and has a pension and has absolutely no interest in talking about the stock market or what's going on in the economy, because they simply don't care. They're not worried about it. They've got a full pension and they're living off that very nicely. Mm-hmm. And whatever they saved, obviously, along the way, but they're really not losing any sleep. Right. And we know you can't argue with somebody when they say to you, you know, I've got a great pension. The pension plan where I worked was really well managed. It was, you know, how come that pension did so well through all the thick and thin of the last 30 or 40 years of your life, that you never had to worry about whether or not you were going to get a paycheck from that pension at the end, mm-hmm. or, you know, for the rest of your life? And until we had the capability to do that, to think that way, which started happening within the last 10 years and in earnest in the last six, where we now have access, greater access or accessibility to privates and alternatives and other uncorrelated multi-strategy type situations that we can invest in. But we're not, you know, like most of us haven't been in the mindset of, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of institutions are talking about, you know, now you have the opportunity to invest in these asset categories that were once only available to institutions, once only available to large investors and pension funds. Mm-hmm. And now we can do it. And the time it's taking to actually gear up for that is very long. It's a very long runway in general. Gearing up for that as an advisor, for example, is not easy. It's a very steep learning curve. The adoption process is quite strenuous. It's a lot of work to accomplish or to try and accomplish as let's say a singular advisor or an advisor team. What you're doing essentially is re-engineering the traditional 60-40 portfolio, but with liquidity and opportunity built in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me frame how we approached it. 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago, there wasn't access to a lot of these what I would deem high quality institutional evergreen funds. You know, that there's been a proliferation of those over the past 3 years. 6 years ago, there wasn't really any.
Right.
But so how we structured it is in a pool format. And why did we do it in a pool format? Is because 6 years ago, if you wanted access to institutional quality private assets, these were closed-end structures, drawdown funds, where the minimum commitment was typically, depending on the asset class, about $10 million USD. Right. So you're not, there's not going to be a line item in a client's portfolio that says they've got the Brookfield Global Transition Fund. The only way that you could provide your clients with exposure to these institutional mandates was in a pooled format where the pool was a qualified investor. And then we unitized it and provided access to our clients. So 6 years ago, we built these with, up to 60% of our pool's commitments or investments are in closed-end structures, which is difficult to access for the typical retail client or advisor.
Right.
You're not going to find a lot of firms like ours that have made these drawdown funds, these institutional mandates, a core position of their pools. But that's what we've done. Now, we have certainly embraced the semi-liquid or the evergreen funds. They're great strategies as well. We have them to provide us with liquidity.
Right.
But I think that there's a lot of areas within the private sphere that you're just not going to get in an evergreen fund just because of the structure of those assets. So I think that if you're building a true institutional quality investment platform, you want access to everything. You know, you just don't want to confine yourself to semi-liquid funds. You're not going to give exposure to opportunistic credit or opportunistic real estate or opportunistic infrastructure in an evergreen fund or certain other asset classes that we have access to. So, and it takes a long time. Like I don't think a lot of investors recognize that when you're committing $10 million or $20 million, and I'll give you an example in a moment, when you commit $20 million to a fund, you're not sending a check for $20 million out on Monday.
Right.
You're waiting for those capital calls to come in, and it could take you 4 to 5 years before that $20 million commitment has been fully called, right? So it does, like any firm out there starting this today, and I wish there'd be other firms like ours that would do this, because I think it will benefit all Canadians, is that it's going to take you at least 5 to 6 years to get where you want to be. So it does take a long time. For example, I'm going to give you this example because pretty excited about this one. So we committed back in 2000, I think it was 21, to the Brookfield Global Transition Fund. I know that we're the only wealth counseling firm in Canada that committed to this one. We committed $20 million USD to this one because we, you know, Brookfield is most people have heard of Brookfield. They're a pretty good investor. I'm not sure if you've heard recently, but they and Cameco partnered and bought
Westinghouse Electric.
Westinghouse. No. Right. And their nuclear capabilities. Well, if anyone has read recently, Westinghouse signed a deal with the U.S. government for an $80 billion to build 4 nuclear reactors.
Right.
And I think that's just the beginning. And that when they bought that, the value of Westinghouse was, I think it was about $4.37 billion. Now, I know that is, you know, and I know the U.S. government has said that once it hits $30 billion, they want it to IPO, and they're going to take something like 8% or invest 8% in the public company. So reason I brought that up is that that's not going to be available in a semi-liquid strategy. It takes time when you're investing in private assets, especially closed-end structures. It takes time for that manager to extract as much value or deliver as much value to that asset as possible. You know, you require a lot of patience when you're investing in private assets. But ultimately, if you care about the returns of what you're investing in, and don't care when it comes, but eventually it's going to come, I would highly recommend to look at structures such as these. But again, it takes a long time. Like that, you know, that we committed to that one 4 years ago.
Right, right.
It's not going to do 25% a year. It's not going to do, you know, like they're targeting 10 to 11%. Yeah. I think it'll do better than that, but patience is certainly required when investing in private assets, especially the kinds that we invest in.
It's what is called patient capital.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of patience required for an individual investor is the hurdle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at the ultra high net worth or institutional level, of course, you have the scale, and you have the scale at Kinsta to do that now. But it's also like as you said, even if you have, let's say you could earmark $10 million of your personal wealth to a drawdown deal like the one you described, that's just one deal. You actually do need to diversify that exposure as well. So now you're talking about diversifying into 10 or 20 deals or 30 deals at that $10 million, $25 million scale.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head with our approach. Our approach is a multi-manager, multi-strategy approach that you don't want to, you know, if you had 50 million, you know, if you're a very wealthy individual with $50 million, the odds of you committing $10 million or $20 million to one strategy is probably minimal. So our approach for our high net worth clients is that we want a multi-manager, multi-strategy approach, and that as over time, you know, and something that a lot of investors have probably never even heard of is vintage diversification. And so over time, your pools are not only diversified by manager and strategy, but they're getting vintage diversification. When I talk about vintage diversification, think about if you invested in a private equity fund back in 2006 or 2005. 4 years from now, we're going into the great financial crisis. Those funds back then probably performed exceptionally poorly in the years ahead. So because they have a very finite time horizon to invest and then to dispose of their assets. So if you got into the 2006 and then you got into the 2009 vintage, well, the 2009 vintage, you know, they're buying assets very, very cheaply. It's not just about strategy diversification. It's about vintage diversification as well.
Right, it's your time diversification. You, mm-hmm. you there's timing risk
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Yep. Brent, you've emphasized education a few times for both clients and advisors. What do you think are the biggest myths or misunderstandings you still run into around private or semi-liquid markets? I think we already touched on it contextually, but if you could elaborate on that a little bit, that would be great.
You know what? There's no doubt a lot of Canadian investors have been burned by, you know, quote unquote private assets over the past decade. And I'm not going to name a lot of the private assets that have blown up or people haven't even gotten their money back 10, 12 years later. That's not a unwarranted fear. That's something that actually happened. Right. And I can understand and appreciate the fear that a lot of investors feel when they hear private assets. Oh God, you know, I lost 20 grand that I put into something or whatever. But I think the education part comes that there's not all private assets are built the same. There's a difference between a private assets where they're raising $25 million for working capital for a small oil and gas company versus investing in with a Brookfield in their right. in a infrastructure fund where these assets that they're buying are generating hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue a year. So I think investors have to differentiate what private assets are. Now that said, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, literally you could not, unless you had the, you know, $10 million to commit, you're not getting a high quality institutional private equity or infrastructure mandate. Now, over the past 3 years, we've seen this proliferation of private assets come to market, especially on the private credit side, very high quality institutional managers that have come to Canada and offering, in my opinion, very, very high quality mandates. There's a lot of private equity funds out there. So I think that investors should take a look at what really in what when we talk about private assets, they are more institutional in nature. Right. And I'll give you an example. We invested in a Morgan Stanley private equity fund, I think it was 4 years ago. We committed, I think it was $12.5 million to this. The Investment Management Corp of Ontario did $250 million in the exact same investment strategy that we did. IMCO is not going to commit to a fly-by-night organization. So that's when I talk about institutional investing, we're investing, you know, one of the things we always look at is who are the other investors in these investment strategies right. that we're committing to. And I would say 95% of them tend to be big pension plans, both in Canada and the US. I see a lot of, you know, the retirement system of Texas and New York and right. so on. So those are true institutional mandates. Haitian capital, they don't expect to see returns. How come you didn't do 12% last year or 15%? That's not what investing in private assets are. And I think I bring it back to what you had said earlier when you talked about, someone with a good pension plan that they're living off their pension. And they didn't really stress about what the manager is doing to achieve those returns. Right.
Exactly.
Those are most of those are so our approach, you know, to bring it back is very, very similar to these pension plans, is to provide a return stream or an experience very, very similar to what one's pension plan is like. You don't stress over what your defined benefit pension plan is doing. We're delivering the exact same thing.
I think, you know, it's interesting because, you know, as companies, there was a shift, of course, in the last decade or longer where a lot of companies got away from defined benefits, mm-hmm. started moving to defined contribution, So you know, you can contribute some of your pay to this DC plan, but you got to pick the investment, right? And yeah. people did not like that, right? Most people did not like that. Like, well, why can't you look after it? Because, you know, that was something that you know, pension, the word pension is evocative of, you know, it's like almost like religion. It's faith. You have to have faith, mm-hmm. right? You have faith in the fact that your pension, you know, your pension sponsor is going to do all the due diligence, all the proper, you know, allocation, you know, run the fund prudently, mm-hmm. and you know, in preparation for all potential risks, and then you don't think about it, because I mean, you don't think about it. You know, there's electricity in the wall, but you can't see it. Mm-hmm. And was it? Right? You don't know, you're not, and as you said, you're not wondering. And why not? Why aren't you wondering what the pension fund manager does to achieve that, you know, meeting those long-term liabilities of future pension recipients? You know, that's why the investigation or the curiosity, like for those who are curious, how do I do this? How do I do this for my clients? I don't think there's been a better time to be an advisor. And I don't think there's been a better time to be an investor also, because the world of opportunity that's now accessible, you know, the strategies that are now accessible, the markets that are now accessible, the professionals that are now accessible to everyone on an increasing mm-hmm. basis is starting to leave you with no excuse. But the mindset change is first of all, understanding what is the difference between, you know, investing like a trader or investing like someone who wants to achieve, you know, a structured outcome. I had the question put to me, like, how would you invest if you assume you have no idea what the market's going to do? Right. So you have to let go of all your biases. You have to let go of all your notions about, you know, what's a good investment and what's not, or what's a good asset category and what's not.
Comes down to asset allocation, doesn't it? At the end.
It does. But it comes down to accepting that you don't know.
No one knows
to some degree that you don't know, and because you don't know, even if you believe that yes, stocks for the long run, bonds as a ballast, there's all these other things that you can do to make sure that you don't have to be right. Just prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's not about being right. It's not about, you know, it's great when you are. It's great when you make an investment and it turns out to have been a great call or a great investment to make. That's wonderful when it happens, but it's kind of gravy, right? You didn't make that investment thinking nuclear is going to come back and the U.S. government's going to commit, and that's why we're doing it. You did it because the managers are capable. They've got a long history of success in creating value, turning situations, you know, alchemy, if you want to call it that, you know, where that's the impression I get from a lot of private equity is, you know, taking an existing business and making it 10 times better.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In some cases.
That's the whole thing. That's the idea. And, you know, you can get into a bit of thematic investing when you're doing private assets. And one of the biggest things today, I think, and everyone is very aware of this, is data centers. Data is just look at the demand for data through artificial intelligence. Now, if you want exposure to these big data centers, I'm assuming there's some publicly traded firms that do it, but to invest specifically in a data a firm that builds data centers, I think you've got to go private. And that's an area most of our infrastructure managers that we've allocated money to over the past 5 or 6 years, data is one of the bigger ones that they're investing in. And I don't see that slowing down anytime soon. So you can still be a bit thematic as well when you're when you're committing to private assets.
In our off mic conversation, we talked about, you know, this idea that you know, most people don't realize that 90% of U.S. companies, for example, of U.S. based companies, close to 90% of U.S. based companies that have revenues over $100 million a year. So it's a big category, but they're not available in the publicly traded market. The fact that they're private represents the investable universe in the private equity and private credit space.
Dude,
those are the companies. I mean, we're not talking about companies with $500,000 or $1 million in revenue, because we're talking about companies with $100 million in revenue or more. And so now if you contemplate, you know, for example, a private equity investor group realizing, you know, we could take this $100 million a year company and make it a $2 billion a year company or a $10 billion a year company just by making a few changes to the way the company does their business, how they're attracting, you know, what their model is, things like that. And someone would say to that private equity group, well, how do you know you can do that? Because because we've done it already. We've done it before with 10 other companies.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a template or a formula that we start with in order to do that. And we can see how we could make that happen here in this particular, you know. And those are the opportunities, those kinds of opportunities, as you said, like the data centers opportunity, like those are not going to be publicly available unless they go public. And at this point, they don't need to, because they're attracting enough capital that there is no requirement to take those businesses public.
A lot of businesses are just deciding they don't want to go public.
Exactly.
Because of all of that capital available through the private markets, from private credit, et cetera. And so a lot of companies are deferring or deciding that we're never going to go public because of the reporting requirements, et cetera, when you are and scrutiny when you are a public company. So the number of companies that were publicly traded, I can't remember the statistics, but the number of companies that were publicly traded, say 25 years ago, has shrunk dramatically as companies have gone from public to private. And I think that trend is not going to reverse anytime soon.
It's almost an alarming trend, but if you, depending on how you know where you stand, but the fact that even large publicly traded companies are opting to go private by being acquired by private equity groups is also astonishing.
Yeah, it's tough as a public company to have a long-term strategic plan in place that you know is going to impact your business short-term, earnings, et cetera. Like, you'll never, I doubt we'll ever see SpaceX go public.
Exactly.
The scrutiny on Musk for, you know, some of his pet projects. Why is he doing that? It's not accretive to corporate revenue. Why are you doing that? Like, get rid of these pet projects of yours. And so I just don't see like a SpaceX ever going public. I think a lot of these companies, especially when you have very long-term strategy in place, if you're a public, that quarterly scrutiny is I'm pretty sure that's one of the major reasons why companies are deferring going public or deciding we're just not going to go public, or we're going to go private. Was it EA a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Electronic Arts, yeah. $55 billion.
Yeah. So these are not small deals. These are big companies.
These used to be, you know, standard merger and acquisition situations that happened between public companies. But the fact that private companies are amassing that kind of capital and have the ability to go and do, you know, some kind of a buyout like that, whether it's leveraged or not, is astonishing. Like, just to see that happening and to see that the public markets are shrinking while private markets are expanding.
Yeah, I think it's the access to capital that wasn't there a long time ago. You know, after the GFC, you know, there was a vacuum created as the banks, the traditional banks, exited the lending space, especially for private companies. And in stepped, whenever there's a vacuum, someone's going to step into that vacuum. And it was the institutional managers or institutional firms that started launching all these private credit funds that, to provide private credit. And so I think that helped accelerate a lot of these companies deciding to stay private for longer.
Yeah. So Brent, we've talked a little bit about the liquidity. I want to talk about liquidity, and you talked a little bit about the liquidity illusion. When it comes to the liquidity illusion, how do you frame that conversation with clients who say, you know, they need liquidity or they just simply desire it when they probably actually don't?
You know, if you're investing for, most people are investing for the long term, right? I'm 30 years old. I'm going to retire it in 30 years. I'm an investor. Maybe once you start getting into your 60s and 70s, okay, you're no longer an investor. You're starting to use that capital. I think I've heard this argument a lot to try to dissuade people from investing in privates. What if my client needs liquidity? Well, if your client needs liquidity, I'm hoping that you've already structured and taken that liquidity, potential liquidity need, into account when you've structured their portfolio. I think it's a red herring, to be honest with you. I think a lot of there's a new generation of advisors that have never experienced sustained drawdowns. I've read this on LinkedIn. You know, if you don't have 85% of your clients in passive indexes, you don't know what you're doing. So that's the narrative that's being driven. Right. Liquidity, I think it is a red herring. Most clients do not need 100% of their portfolio liquid tomorrow.
Right.
If they do, they should have predominantly cash in their portfolio. So I think it's an overused fear tactic. Now, I think there is an illusion of a lot of these semi-liquid strategies that, okay, you know, I'm going to put my money into this evergreen fund, and when I need the capital, just put in my redemption. It's 90 days liquidity. Maybe it's not going to be there when you need it for whatever reason, right? Investors have to recognize that they are investing in a strategy that is long-term capital. There is not, if you're investing in a real estate fund that just bought some student housing in Europe, those aren't liquid. Just like your home is not liquid, you can't sell it tomorrow. And that's where the gating comes, which I think gating in a lot of circumstances is the appropriate response to a run on their assets. Assuming there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the assets. But listen, if I'm an investor and an advisor looking to invest on behalf of my client, for myself, in some private assets that is 90-day liquidity, I'd go into that assuming when I needed that liquidity, it's not there. Okay, if you've got 20% of your portfolio in illiquid assets, you got 80% in liquid assets.
Right.
So I'm not sure why a client really needs that liquidity, you know, 100% liquidity. It may not be there when you need it. So I would always go with that mindset is that, listen, can I afford 20% of my portfolio to be locked up for the next 5 years? That's the way I would take it. You know what? And if you're 30 years old or 35 or 40 years old, and you still have a 5 to 10 to 25 to 30 year time horizon, there's nothing wrong with having 20% of your client's portfolio in illiquid assets. A typical client of ours probably has, at this point, 60% in private assets.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we're a big outlier within the industry, but with that illiquidity, our investors, our clients are getting access to a broad spectrum of private assets that are just not available to the typical retail investor. So there's a trade-off. Do you really need 100% of your portfolio to be liquid? Because if you do, you probably shouldn't have any equities, first of all. There is a trade-off.
Either it's a functional problem, like, you know, you shouldn't be investing in long-term assets if you're going to need all your capital tomorrow, or next month or next year. You should be investing appropriately for the time frame that you think you might need all those assets. But if you're not, and the rest of it boils down to maybe just fear. You know, what if I do need it? What if something goes wrong and I need to get my hands on it? I think maybe past financial crises have done that. I think especially the GFC may have put some of that fear back into the market. As you said, I think you can make that liquidity a structural part of their portfolio. You can make it a strategic part of their portfolio so that in the event, like, let's say you're worth, you have $5 million invested with us. What are the chances that you'll need, $500,000 or $1 million immediately?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if they say it's pretty high, okay, well, let's set that aside.
Yeah. We'll structure the portfolio to meet those potential liquidity needs. So
you have a liquidity sleeve in your portfolio, you have an illiquidity sleeve in your portfolio, and then you have your traditional publicly traded assets in your portfolio.
I should point out that our three private pools all have a certain amount of daily liquidity built into them, just for that. You know, clients are always using their money, and so if we're taking some from our strategic income or strategic growth, then we have that liquidity available without impacting the more longer term private assets in the portfolio.
So Brent, you've taken Kinsted down is a pretty institutional path with exposure to firms like Ares, KKR, Brookfield. How exactly did that shift happen? Like, I know it didn't happen overnight. And how much of it ties back to your experience in your past work?
I guess two responses to that. I mean, when I was heading up the multi-asset strategies group, I had exposure to a lot of bigger pensions. Both here, Europe, and Asia, and you understand what their investment philosophy is. So there was that part of it, understanding or seeing what others were doing. Unfortunately, managing retail assets, you don't have the ability to invest in those. And the other part is just making relationships over time to... this is a relationship business,
right?
The management business and fostering and creating relationships over a 30-year period that you can tap into over time, because people move around. Like, I remember one of my contacts was with BlackRock on the institutional side. He ended up with a Pretium Partners, which is a firm that does a very unique private asset strategies, we probably have $100 million with Pretium today, built on those relationships. And so, once we decided that we're going to go down this route in 2019, again, it didn't happen overnight. it takes a significant amount of time, or took a significant amount of time, to get us from 100% Publix to where we are today.
Right. You have the dedicated teams within your organization. Mm-hmm. You have within Kinstead that are overseeing the different parts of the portfolio as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? But I think the part that's really underestimated is the relationship. The part, you know, what you mentioned about this being a relationship business. You have a compounded knowledge of the people. Like, you've gotten to know them, they've gotten to know you. You know what you can expect from them. You know, yeah, what they can expect from, you know, they know what they can expect from you, and likewise, which is obviously the basis of the relationship. You get to know people, and reputationally, you get to know them as well, and you know that you can have faith in what they've said to you because you've worked with them.
Yeah, you cannot overestimate the importance of relationships in this industry. And I'll give you one example. We were very fortunate to, in a small private equity fund we owned, there was one holding in there that is a small part of the portfolio, and it was IPOing in August or September. And we were offered an opportunity to invest, to get more, to access more at the IPO price. This firm had, because of the very, very strong relationship with the CEO of the firm, I'm not going to mention the name of the firm, but he had a very good relationship with this private equity firm. They offered them $30 million of additional equity. They kept 15, and they offered 15 million to other investors. Now we've got a very, very strong relationship with them. I said, well, you know what? I'd like 5.6 million out of your 15. Well, it was 32 times oversubscribed. We ended up with 4.6 million US. Mm-hmm. I was told there was an institution that put in they wanted $50 million. They were given $25,000 in equity. That's where relationships matter.
Right.
Is getting access to that type of investment solely based on relationships. If we didn't have that relationship, there's no way that we would ever have gotten access to that amount of capital.
Yeah, I think that's probably, you know, that's probably the most underestimated. You know, you see somebody, you know, you read somebody's bio, you read their profile, you understand that they've got a track record, but it's not really conveying the full story, which includes, you know, the relationships. I think, you know, people spend, this is a business where people do spend 20, 30, 40 years or longer in the business. And the reason they have that longevity is because they've cultivated good relationships across the system. And trust, exactly.
Trust is so important. Yeah.
Right. I mean, if word got around that, like, you know, if somebody screws you, you know, they're done.
I always hear
this. If somebody does you wrong, you're never going to deal with them again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always hear these stories about private equity or private infrastructure, and it's all, they're all made up. All these numbers are made up, right? Like, they can value them whatever they want. But think about a KKR. I don't know what the latest vintage of their fund is. It's vintage 16. Do you think if they had not delivered on returns, on the promise of those returns, that they would be on vintage 16? If Brookfield had been unsuccessful on vintage 1, 2, 3, do you think they'd be on vintage 8 of their infrastructure fund, right? No. So that's why I always say to investors that large institutional investors are very conservative when they're pricing their assets. Why is that? Because number one, the last thing they want to do is when they exit a position, which ultimately they will have to, they don't want to have to write it down and say, oh, Brent, by the way, we just sold this asset. We're writing it down 15%. Okay. Right. What are the odds? Because these private asset firms are always looking to their next capital raise. And if their prior fund sucked, or they overpromised, or they wrote assets up, or they had to write asset values down, there's going to be a lot of skepticism with investors the next time they're up for a capital raise. So I again, that comes to trust. I trust that Brookfield has been doing this for 30 or 40 years and that they will continue to deliver on what they've promised. So trust is so important.
Right. Well, yeah, obviously one bad taste is enough to end.
Sour you. Yep.
Yeah. To sour things. Absolutely. So I want to talk about something that you've partnered with Morgan Stanley on recently, which is the Alpha Engine.
Mm-hmm.
Their portable alpha multi-strategy hedge fund platform.
Mm-hmm.
That's portable alpha is a concept that's been enjoying a revival in the last number of years. It's an exciting concept. What sparked that idea and how did it fit into the evolution of what your clients can now access? How are you making use of it?
Let's forget about the portable part.
Okay.
I'll get into that in a moment, but I think alpha strategies have been a core component of a lot of institutional investors over the past couple of decades. And just for listeners, what is an alpha strategy? If you look at equities, so if you invest in an actively managed U.S. equity fund, you're hoping the manager is going to outperform, let's say, the S&P 500. If that manager outperforms the S&P by 200 basis points, that 200 basis points is alpha. That alpha is delivered in one way, security selection. With alpha engines or alpha strategies, you know, you can have a long-short fund. That's an alpha strategy. You can have a merger arbitrage or a global macro. The way we've approached it and the way that Morgan Stanley has been doing this for 25 years and the way most big institutional investors have been doing it is using I've always used the multi-manager, multi-strategy concept through here today with Kinsed and through when I was with Franklin Templeton. So we approached Morgan Stanley probably back in the spring to build a bespoke hedge fund solution. There's a combination of 29 managers all managing different hedge fund strategies, and they're managing it with a target annualized volatility of 2.5% to 4% per year, which is lower than when you're going to get in fixed income. And the targeted return today is SOFR plus 4 to 6. Well, SOFR today is about 4%. So you're looking at an annualized rate of return of 8 to 10. Now, a lot of investors might go, I'll just buy the S&P 500. Thank you very much. 8 to 10, right. That really doesn't do much for me. Where a lot of institutional investors, what the vast majority of institutional investors are doing is they're using an alpha engine as a fixed income replacement. Because it's got, this alpha engine has essentially zero beta to both equities and fixed income.
Right.
So the way we're approaching it, now we could have said, okay, we're going to reduce our fixed income. We'll take whatever, 25, 30, 40% of our fixed income and allocate it to an alpha engine. But how we're doing it is we're using it as a portable alpha strategy. So how that works is that we're getting, and by the way, the minimum commitment to a strategy like this with Morgan Stanley in particular was $100 million. So this is not something that you're just going to go and definitely not retail. So the portable alpha strategy is, so with that $100 million, Morgan Stanley gets into a total return swap for us. And the beta we've selected is the MSCI World. Just give us world exposure. So we're getting the MSCI World plus the alpha engine. So at the end of the day, the targeted return is MSCI World plus 4-6%.
Right.
I think that's pretty darn attractive. Now, a lot of investors are going to go, whoa, that's a lot of leverage. That's pretty risky, isn't it? I would say no, because if you think about hedge funds 25 years ago, they had a lot of beta. Would I use an alpha engine with a high beta to the markets as a portable? No, I wouldn't, because then you're doubling up your risk. But with a beta to the equity markets of essentially zero, the drivers of return on an alpha engine are very, very different and unique from what you're going to get from purely security selection. So at the end of the day, and this is going to be 55% of our global equity pool is in a portable alpha strategy, which I said it's index plus 4-6.
That's incredible.
It's an absolute return strategy.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the historical, and Morgan Stanley's been doing this for 25 years, so they've got a very, very long track record of doing this. But what's really interesting about this strategy is that it does exceptionally well in volatile equity markets, especially when markets are going through drawdowns. This is when it tends to add a lot of alpha.
Well, that's just that you're using leverage to increase, to add an equal amount of holdings in what are uncorrelated strategies. I think that's the key. But you're not having to forego your beta.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting a beta plus the alpha. And
that's long been the diversification dilemma, right? Is that you have to sell something in order to the dilemma is that you always traditionally had to sell either your stocks or your bonds or both or some of both in order to get into a diversifier. And with portable alpha,
you don't. You know, it's interesting is someone asked Morgan Stanley, we had an event where the deputy CIO of the group was presenting on the strategy, which by the way, launched officially on October 1st. And they asked him, why isn't anyone else doing this? And I think he was very confused with the question because it came from more of a retail perspective, where his focus is on institutional. His largest client in this strategy is a large Asian sovereign wealth fund with $1.2 billion. And so when that question was asked is, why isn't anyone else doing this? He said, well, everyone is doing this. it's just not being done in the high net worth space. And I could tell you, this is not being done in the US there's no similar firm to ours doing this in the US or Canada. Now, you can buy AQR. AQR is a great has a great multi-strat. I think there's a bit more beta in there than that. I don't think would be conducive as a portable alpha strategy. But yeah, there's from my understanding, there's no other private wealth firm doing what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing it with Morgan Stanley within your pools.
That's correct.
In terms of the institutional nature of how you're going about it is what is really differentiating how you're using portable alpha in your multi-strategy portfolios.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I think that's very unique. But the concept of portable alpha, as you said, has been around for 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
Originally, I think it was first developed by PIMCO.
Yeah, my understanding is that the individuals who started up the Morgan Stanley portable alpha strategy came from the Weyerhaeuser pension plan.
Right.
And they basically, the whole pension plan was a portable alpha strategy. And then they said, we should be doing this for other institutions. And ultimately, they joined Morgan Stanley to do that.
Suddenly, you know, the light bulb goes off. You know, we could be doing this everywhere. That was a funny question. What you said was, you know, the question, why isn't anybody else doing this? No, everybody else is.
They are. Just not on the on the high net worth side.
But the portable alpha concept is something that's really gaining a fair amount of momentum these days, and that's it makes for very exciting conversations. I think, you know, when you can actually sit down with a client and show them how it works and what they're getting in return, instead of trying to be a better stock picker or better securities, or better at securities selection, you're foregoing even that problem, which is that you don't have to be a better stock picker. Keep your beta, keep your exposure in you know, your S&P 500 index, but now add these structural alpha components to your portfolio instead, which all these incremental returns that you can add to your underlying portfolio, but on top of it, instead of having the trade-off of having to sell stocks and bonds in order to do that, you no longer have to.
That's the key.
Yeah.
You're basically saying, I think it's easier to get alpha in other formats rather than security selection.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
It is. It absolutely is. Like, you know, I mean, being able to do it in the past was something that could only happen at the institutional level. And now, of course, you know, you're doing it within your investment pools in your firm, at the institutional level. But it is also starting to become increasingly available as at the retail level as well, even for everyday investors to learn how to employ portable alpha or return stacking.
Yep.
What's a way for advisors to, you know, who are listening to this and probably wondering, okay, you know, that's great. You know, thanks, Brent, for that explanation and for all that you're doing. But, you know, how do I actually, you know, do something like this? How do I plug into this? Brent, how do you see Kinsted partnering with advisors who want to bring institutional style portfolios to their clients without having to reinvent the wheel?
There's two ways, Pierre, that we currently work with advisors. The first way is that there's a lot of advisors out there who are financial planners, you know, estate planning, insurance focused, that don't really want to be involved in the money management aspect. Those advisors are partnering with us through a referral arrangement where they're outsourcing their clients' wealth management to us. Now, everything we do is on a discretionary basis. So we manage clients on a discretionary basis. So that's the first way that an advisor can partner with us. And that really, I would say, has been the growth of our firm the past 4 or 5 years is through referral advisors. The other is that we recently, I guess about a year ago, started offering our 3 private pools as standalone options for advisors who wanted access to institutional private assets in a packaged, let's call it a packaged solution. And that's the other way advisors can access our 3 private pools. Now, we have a number of relationships with ICPM firms who are using our 3 private pools, and getting on the shelves is the more difficult aspect. So we are on Designed Wealth platform. Our 3 private pools are available on through Designed Wealth. So that would be the other option for advisors.
Advisors that are coming to you and referring their clients to Kinsted to manage that part of their portfolio, their investment management, they can participate in the process as much or as little as they like. They can be 100% part of the conversations, meetings that you have with their clients, or less.
Yeah, most advisors are involved with their clients when we have quarterly meetings or semi-annual or whatever it is. Usually the advisor is part of those discussions as well. I mean, they're safeguarding their clients' assets. And if we do a poor job for the client, that advisor is free to take his client's assets away from Kinstead and go to another firm if that's what they want.
You're making it as easy as possible.
Yes.
For them to partner with you.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
By having already done the groundwork for this, you know, at your own firm, you're actually making it relatively straightforward for advisors who want to add this capability to their business by offering it to them in a flexible way.
I think so. And something we didn't touch on is that because our private pools are backed by private clients, over $1 billion of our three private pools are private client money, which tends to be relatively sticky, long-term focus, we're able to provide daily liquidity through our three pools to any advisor who wants to partner with us. So clients have access to their money on a daily basis, which is something pretty unique in the Canadian marketplace. I can almost guarantee you that there is not another private asset solution like this that provides daily liquidity. And fortunately for us, we're able to do that because of who is backing these pools.
If you had one takeaway for advisors about where the industry's headed and what they need to do to stay relevant in the next cycle, what would it be?
I think for advisors who are looking at private assets or who are swimming against the tide and trying to demonize the private market space, I think you are either going to be proactive or you're going to be reactive. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, every single advisor out there is going to be using private assets to a certain degree. How much? I don't know. But those advisors who think, I am never going to use private assets, you will be using private assets. You either can start doing it now or you're going to be forced to do it. Like I said earlier, a lot of advisors have not experienced sustained drawdowns. The S&P 500 took what, from 2000 to 2014 to break even?
Right.
If you're under the age of 40 today, you've never experienced that. I'm not saying that's going to happen next year, but it's happened in the past. And, you know, it's going to be tough for clients or an advisor's clients to go through an environment like that. Listen, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it is what it is. You're no different than any other client. Well, today, I think if you don't have or you're not providing exposure to your clients to what I would deem high quality institutional assets, I think you're doing your clients a disservice. So either embrace it today or you're going to be forced to embrace it.
That's quite a statement. Mm-hmm. When the basis for measuring the value of companies or the value of paper is changing the way it has been for the last several years since we had inflation's comeback, central bank policy tightening as rapidly as it did, and most likely as sustainably as it might be at what are probably normal levels, you can no longer count on assets to be valued the way they were potentially the last 40 years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you anymore. I mean, that's our base case. Anyone who looks at historical data knows that the S&P 500 is trading at extreme levels based on history. JP Morgan puts out a really good chart you can access at any time, showing the current the forward looking PE is 23 times. And you look at other periods where the S&P was trading at a 23 forward-looking multiple and said, well, what was the future 10-year rate of returns based on that?
Right.
They were typically negative to flat. So I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I think you've got to, it's hard to say, yeah, but it's going to be different this time. Like, I don't know why it's going to be different this time, but, and you also have to think about is inflation going to remain stickier now than it has in the past? You know, and I can talk at length on why on that, but if you do think that inflation is going to be relatively sticky, you know, is that long-term correlation where, you know, if you go through difficult economic environments, bonds rally, yields go down, equities go down, but you're benefiting from the fixed income. Is that temporarily going to break down like it did in 2022, where bonds went down and equities went down? So there was a cyclical breakdown in correlations. Now, is this going to be a more of a secular? I don't think so. But I think we have to ask, is fixed income going to deliver the downside benefits in difficult economic environments that they did in the past? I'm somewhat skeptical about that. Why I say that is because the Fed put is gone.
Right.
The Fed cannot go and rescue the financial markets the way it did before. Why is that? Because there's something called inflation that they have to be very concerned about, something that didn't exist for God knows 20 years. And the way I think about, China joined the World Trade Organization, I think it was in 2000, which brought an era of low inflation. You know, that was when, globalization really started. And what I see, and I think what a lot of other people see, is that, you know, globalization probably hit its peak several years ago. So if you think that globalization, it was inherently deflationary, you got to think the opposite, that it's inherently not deflationary, but maybe lead to a bit more inflation or sustained inflation or higher than what central banks believe inflation is going to be. So you look at all of that and you go, well, how do I diversify a portfolio today?
Right.
I think you've got to be in privates. Absolutely. And there's a lot of privates, especially on the real asset side, that benefit from higher inflation. So.
Well, that's just it. There's so many different opportunities and outcomes that you can choose from.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Brent, thank you so much for this incredible conversation and your valuable time and insight.
It's been a real pleasure. Really enjoyed it, Pierre.